Succession number 28410, Reel 2.
Only had a limited knowledge of his policy, which was based probably on discussion with the equivalent then of what today would be called a backpacker. I was speaking to this young bloke in the YMCA gymnasium in Brisbane, who told me he had recently ridden a bicycle through Germany and showed me a souvenir he had acquired from a German youth-type soldier, which was a small dagger with a swastika on the handle and engraved with the German equivalent of blood and honour. This indicated that there was much greater emphasis on the importance of military training in Germany than was apparent in Australia at the time.
What about the sort of sense of nationalism that was being portrayed in places like Germany? Was there something similar in Australia?
Oh, I don't think so. Not to my knowledge. Australia was a fairly free and easy sort of existence. The Depression limited the amount of travel one could indulge in as compared with today, where everyone has access to vehicle transport. In those days, one's travel was restricted to mainly railway or tramway, or in some cases, bus services. This required paying fares, and one, generally speaking, couldn't afford it.
You mentioned the situation in Australia, and obviously the changing political situation in places like Germany is an almost direct result of the Depression, but also their harsh treatment at Versailles. Did you have any knowledge of how the Depression and possibly the Treaty of Versailles had affected Germany?
Not in those years, as I now have, as a result of what you might call my post-Second World War reading of history.
So at the time, did you have any understanding of Hitler's policies toward Lebensraum or living space?
Not really, not personally, no.
So when he starts to violate the treaties in 36, violates the Versailles Treaty by walking into the Rhineland, and then in 38, March the 12th, across the Austrian border and demanding Sudetenland around Czechoslovakia. Did you have any understanding of those things?
Yes, I think we understood what was going on, as I previously mentioned, from our reading of the newspapers of the day.
So when Chamberlain went over in 38 to Munich, what do you recall of that experience?
I distinctly recall seeing motion picture newsreels of Chamberlain arriving back in London, waving the paper, which he said had been signed by Hitler, and in which speech he more or less indicated that all was going to be well. I would say that at that time, I and a lot of other people realised that he had probably been hoodwinked by Hitler and that things were beginning to look serious.
Well, certainly Churchill believed he'd been hoodwinked. He mentions, "We have sustained a total and unmitigating defeat." what were your thoughts of people like Chamberlain and Churchill at this time?
Well, I must confess that I was not at that time and that age very politically oriented one way or the other.
In relation to the belief, possibly, that war had been averted, was there a serious belief that, that the world might shy away from another war?
I'm not so sure about that, but I believe that in the militia, we began to realise that things were getting serious when, for example, we no longer went into annual camp with horse-drawn guns, but found that civilian motor trucks had been commandeered or hired to pull the antique 18-pounder guns that we were equipped with, which had metal shod wheels and not pneumatic tyres. It was fairly apparent to us that we were not up to date with military hardware.
What do you recall of the situation in Poland prior to the war?
My knowledge of Poland prior to the war was virtually nil. My knowledge of Poland since the war is quite extensive, because in the post-Second World War era, I worked for some years with an engineer whom, not at that time, but subsequently discovered, had escaped from Poland the day the Germans invaded, and travelled via the Middle East to France and then to Britain, where he attended Sandhurst Military College and became an officer in the Polish Armoured Corps and was involved in the invasion of Normandy and decorated. I've learnt a lot from books he has written of his experiences since the war, but I can only now recall quite clearly the Australian Prime Minister Menzies making a radio announcement after the Germans invaded Poland and the British declared war on Germany, Menzies saying that because Great Britain was at war with Germany, we are now also at war.
How did that make you feel?
At that stage, to be quite candid, I fully expected that the Australian government would call up all persons serving in the then CMF and went to the trouble of making sure I had my uniform, bandolier, leggings, boots and spurs readily accessible. it was not long after that that we went into much longer military camps at a place called Caloundra, north of Brisbane.
So you were looking forward to the experience.
One didn't really look forward, I would say, to war. One looked forward to the fact that it was a culmination of your training, and it looked like it was going to be exciting.
To what degree did you look for adventure as a young bloke? You mentioned you went and joined the artillery and for something to do. How did you see the war possibly as a similar?
I must confess that there wasn't to me a direct connection between being in the CMF pre-war with the thought of actually going to war. It wasn't until war broke out that one realised that being in the CMF was something that could possibly lead to one being involved in a rather dangerous enterprise, which was war. I think the idea of being in the CMF pre-war was one, it gave one the opportunity of becoming involved in something which was exciting and interesting and for which you were paid. You had a rather glamorous uniform which you could, after the finish of parades at the barracks, wear down into town and what would one call it? Looking for stalking opportunities.
Made you feel good wearing that uniform.
Yep. Oh yes, I would say that most felt rather proud to wear those uniforms, which in the main fitted quite well. The long trousers had a red stripe down the side. The jacket was a dark navy blue. And your cap had a red band on it. The buttons were polished brass. As distinct from the incredible uniforms which were issued after war broke out and one joined an AIF unit.
Incredible in what way?
Well, the uniforms that were issued when one joined the AIF, for example, were in the first instance uniforms that had been stored since the end of the First World War, in particular greatcoats, in which many new recruits to the AIF found notes with the name and the address of the lady or girl who made them, who then turned out to be a grandmother rather than a girl.
Ken, can we talk about, you mentioned being in uniform and going into town. How did women look at blokes in uniform?
Well, I find it difficult to answer a question as to how the women looked at men in uniform. Perhaps to put it another way, it was how the men in uniform looked at the women that they came in contact with. For example, there were a group of six or seven of us who used to go down into Brisbane after we left the barracks to a coffee shop. And my mates who were with me there obviously decided to tell one of the rather attractive waitresses there, unbeknownst to me, that I would like to take her out. So I was surprised when she approached me later in the evening while we were drinking our coffee and said, "I'll go out with you if you invite me." So I capitalised on the opportunity and made arrangements to pick her up on a subsequent evening and take her out. A friend of mine, who was a rather older person than me and who owned a single-seater antique Rolls Royce about 1926 vintage, on occasions would lend me the car for the purpose of taking a girlfriend for a drive. So I borrowed the car from him and parked it outside the restaurant on a subsequent night when she was knocking off early enough for me to take her somewhere, and went in and met her. She came out, and there was the usual crowd of people gathered round this old Rolls Royce. And she said to me, "What's the matter with that car?" I found that a difficult question to answer, but manoeuvred her into the front seat, drove the car down the road, turned right, then right again, and parked it outside Her Majesty's Theatre in Brisbane, where I had purchased tickets to take her to see the musical stage show Rosemary. And later, drove her not very far from the heart of Brisbane to where she lived in South Brisbane. That was virtually the end of that romance, because it wasn't very long after that that war broke out and I disappeared from the local scene in the red striped trouser uniform, and went overseas with the AIF in my khaki uniform.
Let's talk then about, was there ever a sort of sense of peer group pressure in joining up? People talk of receiving the white feather in the First World War and things like that. Was that something that you ever heard of or experienced among your friends?
No, I can't say that there was any pressure to join the second AIF, although there were, of course, recruiting posters or advertisements, as I recall, now and then. I joined the AIF from a CMF camp in April, I think it was, in 1940. I'd actually been in camp on a number of occasions from the outbreak of the war in September, if I remember correctly. And we finished up in a three-month camp, and it was from that camp where we were more or less invited to volunteer for a new artillery unit for the 7th Division of the 2nd AIF. We were trained as field artillery, and as I've mentioned previously, I had risen to the rank of sergeant, and so we all, or many of us, joined the AIF to become members of the 2nd Anti-Tank Regiment, later called the Tank Attack Regiment. The name Tank Attack didn't go over well with people who had been used to calling themselves the Anti-Tank Regiment members. We went into a training location at a town called Redbank, which was a relatively short railway trip out of Brisbane. And those of us who held rank in the CMF retained that rank in the new unit. And as a sergeant, I was responsible for the training of our new recruits, who consisted of young men who joined from both town and country areas in the vicinity of Brisbane. These included men such as cane cutters, shearers, axemen, and many others from assorted walks of life, from office work to manual labour. And surprisingly enough, included many whose date of birth on enlistment was such that meant they were just under the maximum age which you could be. This was because the many of them were people from the First World War who reduced their age in order to join up.
How did people like cane cutters and axemen take to being trained by you? A pretty tough mob.
Yes. I recall one of my gunners who was very efficient at taking the crown seal off a bottle of beer with his teeth. And on one route march out in the farmland surrounding Redbank, as we were marching along the road, I suddenly saw my squad dissipate in all directions. And this particular gunner then handed me a headless snake, which he had grabbed by the tail as it went across the road and cracked it like a stop whip and cracked the head off. I had heard of this being done, but had never believed it possible or ever seen it done before. But there it was, a headless snake being held by a gunner and offered to me. It wasn't long after that we passed a country pub and had a 10-minute break from our route march while the members of the troop went in and slaked their thirst with a 4X Queensland beer. I'll never forget Bill Church picking up that snake. He was one of my gunners for quite a long time through the war. A very nice bloke. And he subsequently, post-war, continued as a friend of mine, in spite of the fact that he suffered from a complaint called Burgess disease, which was something to do with smoking, and finished up with both legs amputated at the hip, and was driving a car specially modified for him, and walked on his hands even up the front stairs of my house, much to the surprise of my wife.
Let's talk about what the training involved.
Early training for all people consisted of normal, what you would call parade ground drill, and in particular handling the 303 rifle, which was the same rifle as was used in the latter stages, or many of the stages of the First World War.